Why do I have a headset on? I don't know what we're talking about.
Just let it happen, mate.
Just hit record. I'm going to put your glasses on and
yeah,
it will make
that'll
me
help.
So much smarter.
Oh, instant intelligence.
You look like you're in an indie band.
A squared plus B squared equals C squared.
It's actually C squared equals A squared plus B squared.
Paracetamol for a child is served at 1.5 mil. Served?
This is what you are.
Here you go.
See that?
Administered. See what happens when I put glasses.
Fraud.
Imposter syndrome. Yeah. We just recorded about that.
Can I have my glasses back?
They're yours.
Thank you.
What are we talking about?
Oh, that's better. Chip.
No, thank you. They're cool.
They're still good.
Love to know what the topic is.
Dairy milk?
Shabby.
Don't join him, Lou.
Don't get in on it.
It's not a safe place.
What's the topic? You have my paper.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't dare.
Has this been drawn from us or a student? Or a listener?
This was from an audience member.
Oh, one of the recent symposiums.
I don't know. But say that, yes. Yes.
And the question would be?
Do you want to answer this one?
I'm going to draw
it. It said, I have two questions, right? This is from Dakota.
Hello, Dakota.
Dakota says, heya.
Hello.
She must be young. She says, hey.
I do. I like Dakota already.
Wait.
I know. We've met her.
Yes.
Wow.
She was lovely. She was in the car park of the last symposium saying g'day.
In the car park?
Yeah, but she was helping us. Well, she helped us carry everything out.
Did she?
Yeah.
She was so great.
Thank you, Dakota.
Dakota.
Dakota. Thank you, Dakota, if you're watching this. She said, hello. I was lucky enough to be at your symposium at QUT and was blown away.
Hold on. This is an internal message. Just read the question, not the whole message.
I'm just trying to give you some kudos.
Yes. Penguin. Penguin.
How did she know that?
That's not a penguin.
I know animals.
That's a bald penguin.
My question was, do penguins have ears or like, how do I make that more penguin?
No, that's perfect. No, they don't have, I don't think they have ears. That's an owl. You've just changed it. Well, I think they have little ears, but.
Back to the question.
They've got little flappers on the side.
Flappers?
Well, the
fins.
Wings. The wings that don't fly.
Wings.
All right, the question.
Have you seen a penguin in the wild before?
Absolutely.
See, this is what
fairy
happens.
Penguins?
You were trying to get us back on track and you just joined us. What's the question?
I was trying to give you a bit of praise.
Have you guys seen penguins? I love penguins.
Only at Melbourne Zoo.
Oh, that's not real.
No, you can't count an animal you haven't seen in the wild.
Yeah, it's not real.
Well, I haven't seen one then.
Well, then you haven't. Question.
Dakota was giving us some positive feedback.
Thank you, Dakota.
Thank you.
She even said, I swear I'm not bullshitting you. Just in case we thought she was lying.
Mm.
It's nice.
Hmm. Authentic.
She said, Lou was amazing, Nick was great, Sonny's weird.
That's a shame.
But she had two questions for us.
I don't actually think that's what she said.
I don't think so.
She said, I'm curious about the ethical side of providing medical support to remote expeditions and what medical mental health resources are available to people far from civilization.
The ethical side
of providing medical support for remote expeditions and what mental health resources are available when people are far from civilization.
That's two now, very different questions.
Well, let's use the first one.
Which is good. Okay.
Mm.
Let's start with the first one.
Ethical.
Ethical. Ethics.
Time to get ethical. Sorry.
Sorry. It's not quite how the song goes. Let's get ethical.
Thanks, Kylie.
Let's get ethical. What are the ethical side of delivering care to remote?
Oh, I can't read. Are these my glasses?
Yes.
Shit. The ethical.
Would you like me to read it?
Side of providing medical support for remote expeditions. Now, Sonny, you went on a remote expedition. We could call it a remote expedition. About a year or 18 months ago, and maybe we should use that as the context for answering Dakota's question.
I'm going to sound like a wanker.
You are.
Because I don't know what he's talking about, because in the last 12 months I've gone on 8.
So oh, whoop-dee-doo.
I don't know which one he's referring to.
Look at me, I've been on 8 expeditions, I'm special.
So is this a...
Mr. Flex over here.
It's not what I intended to do.
How many expeditions have you been on?
Oh,
though?
God.
This many?
3.
If you can't identify which job it was... How am I supposed to respond?
All right, let's use one of your 8 expeditions.
Okay. Is it the desert? Is it the ocean? Is it the mountains? Is it the jungle? Like, where is it?
It's in the Australian outback.
Okay. All right. Did it involve human power or motor power?
It involved a variety of motor powers.
Yeah.
And an energy drink.
Oh, okay. All right. Ooh. I know which one you're talking about. Okay.
Yes. And it wasn't Luwak coffee.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. The ethical side of providing medical care... In a remote expedition. Yeah. We're going to use one that's domestic, so one that's based in Australia.
Let's start with that.
Okay. Well, that's... Look, this is an interesting conversation because this actually... I mean, you've got to cycle right back to what is a paramedic even doing out on one of these expeditions because, you know, come 5 years ago, we wouldn't have been 10 years ago, 5 years ago, something. How do we even get linked into this? And often it's actually in the pre-planning stage. So it's someone has an idea. And most of the time, if there is something in a remote environment, it's going to be somewhat outlandish because someone's trying to achieve a world first by human power. Or it's going to be something even more outlandish because a media team are behind it and they're trying to sell a product. Now, the problem you've got is... People are not that strong. The human body is actually quite fragile. And I think we forget about that because we protect ourselves with all the structures that are around us, buildings, electricity, roads, air conditioning, etc. And we're going to take people out of those structures and into a unique environment. So one of the first things you've got to consider is what is that environment? What are the geographical challenges? What are we doing? This was the desert.
She's trying to be really quiet making her protein.
Even the cat's like, ooh.
Ooh.
Kibbles?
Kibbles? Biscuits?
Hi, Bree.
Nick's wife. Do you want to come and join us on this podcast
episode? Nick's wife just walked in. She's come from the gym and she's trying to make a very discreet protein drink, but she made more noise than I make when I'm trying to creep to the bathroom in the middle of the night and not wake my kids. Just mix it with passion now.
It's interesting because I was watching a documentary last night by The North Face. Now, for our listeners, The North Face is an adventure brand. They sell gear, clothing. A bit like, what's another adventure brand?
Patagonia.
Patagonia.
Red Bull.
Red Bull. Red Bull is not an energy drink, really. It's a brand about extreme activities.
It's a media company.
Yeah, correct.
That sell a drink.
Yeah, correct.
Very good at it.
So North Face did a documentary about these 3 Swiss professional skiers and their daughter, or one of their daughters, who sailed a yacht from the bottom of South America across to Antarctica and then snowboarded down a bunch of mountains on the Antarctic Peninsula unsupported. But this opening scene was about the psychological challenges of crossing the Drake Passage, which is the passage of water between Ushuaia, which is the most southern town in South America, where most of the Antarctic expeditions depart from, through the Drake Passage to Antarctic continent. Now, the Drake Passage can be one of 2 things, absolute glass calm sea or a washing machine. They got the washing machine.
It's actually mostly a washing machine. It's actually, it's where the Pacific and Atlantic and Southern Ocean collide. So you got 3 oceans meeting.
Yeah. So they went across this, took them 5 or 6 days to sail across this body of water. And the first 10 minutes of the show was about the psychological challenges of being on a boat that would not stop moving in freezing, windy, rocking sea state.
Mm-hmm. This is part of the pre-planning that I'm referring to. Mm. This is part of the geographical challenges that we've got to take into account because at the end of the day, humans are quite fragile and they're going to try something extraordinary And it's either for TV or it's for research, but either way, we've got to try and keep people safe.
Do you think in your experience as an expedition medic, how much of it is mental health?
See, I've actually changed my definition these days. I used to use expedition medic all the time because 15 years ago, there were no paramedics working in that space, and I almost had to hide that I was a paramedic. I wanted people to assume I was a nurse or a doctor. It's flipped. Thank goodness. We've got a lot more paramedics working in the space. So I actually tell people now I'm an expedition paramedic if that's what I'm doing, because I want people to specifically know that I am a trained paramedic. How much of it is mental health? You can divide this again. It's actually more complex, because mental health, keeping the team aligned and in check, is one of the most challenging things you'll do, and is probably about 70% of what you do. The other 30% is actually planning and risk assessment, and 0.1% is clinical care unless something catastrophic has happened. No, I shouldn't say that, because there is a lot of primary care. But a lot of it is mental health. Why I say it's more complicated than that is because if you're not taking care of your own mental health, you can't even take care of a team. And so when we're actually in this really initial early stage of pre-planning, you actually got to consider your own skills, ability, and experience in that environment. And then you've actually got to consider how you're going to cope yourself with the change in food, the change in routine, the change of familiarity around family, friends, the ability to escape. I mean, if you're on a boat crossing the Drake Passage, guess what? You can't get off. And so you've actually literally just turned your world into 12 foot by 6 foot, and that's it. You can't escape. And so you've actually got to rehearse these types of scenarios in your head even before you step foot on that boat, because you've got to have a strategy to actually maintain your own mental health. People put expedition paramedics on teams now to look after the team with absolutely no consideration of who's going to look after the paramedic if they are injured, sick, or struggling. And if we don't put those strategies in place before we get started, then we're actually making ourselves so much more vulnerable. We probably can't look after the team, therefore can't achieve the goal. So it is that little bit more complicated. But it's interesting that, you know, the case you're talking about, I mean, it's cold, it's ocean. She's going to snowboard down potentially virgin slopes that no one has before. But there's also an element of climbing in there. So there's three very unique technical skills that the crew need to possess. And guess what? If the medic is going to accompany them, the medic actually needs to possess as well. So it needs to be someone who is suitably experienced offshore and working on sailing boats, deckhand, if not a skipper. You need someone who's actually confident walking across ice, crevasse rescue, crampons. You're going to need someone who can climb vertically and rescue. And you're going to need someone who could potentially move down, either climbing, snowboarding, however it is. But these are the things you unpack before you even take on a contract such as these. But this is also the most fun. Ironically, this is probably one of the larger parts of what an expedition paramedic does, and you get zero training for this anyway. You certainly won't get training for this in a degree. You certainly won't get training for this working for a jurisdictional ambulance. You certainly won't get training for this working for a mine site. People then say, well, how do you get the experience, the training? And it is very simple. Have a non-clinical technical skill. If you want to go to Antarctica, well, you're going to have to do some snow time, and not just a, you know, an introduction. You're going to have to get competent and qualified to operate, survive in the snow and look after other people. Because you've got to face it, the expedition paramedic is not just there as a medic. They're actually there as an interim 2IC, 3IC leader, whatever you want to do it. So there is a tremendous aspect to the pre-planning. And I mean, relating this to the question that Dakota asked, the ethical side of providing medical care vastly depends on the legalities around what we're doing as well. Antarctica is a unique example from that documentary that you referenced, because technically no one owns Antarctica. There are no indigenous people. It has just been divided up under the Antarctic Treaty for research purposes. So there, there's a dozen countries that have certain claims to Antarctica, and then certain agreements. But if you bring it back and we look at delivering medical care and expeditions domestically, every state in Australia has different laws that govern what healthcare professionals can do. And so you've very much got to operate within the boundaries of that. And where the ethical dilemmas kind of intersect is where we're going to potentially cross what would be perceived as a legal boundary, sometimes an ethical boundary. And an example would be if if you're in an ambulance service, you should be using the equipment that is provided to you. Let's just use a simple tourniquet as an example. It would be frowned upon to leave that tourniquet in the ambulance and try and improvise one out of a 10-centimeter bandage and a stick. Take yourself out in the desert on the expedition that I went on that you're referring to. If we didn't have the resources or the ability to carry certain pieces of equipment, we've actually got to leave them behind. Now, if there's an opportunity to improvise those, then they are the pieces of equipment that we will ditch. And there's a lot of people who are probably listening who probably think, you know, well, it's such a small piece of equipment, of course you're going to carry it. But if I can use the space medicine projects I've been involved in the past, you're literally limited to, 30 by 20 by 40 centimeter case that can't weigh more than 8 kilos, and you need to build an ALS medical kit for 10 people for 3 months. You literally have to ditch a lot of things that you would never consider ditching before. And so the ethical side of providing medical care is essentially falling back to what would a reasonable person do in a similar circumstance with the skills and abilities that you have. And if you can justify that from a legal perspective, often then ethically, you're going to be in a safe place. But where law and ethics collide is a grey area of mud. Lou, you would have done law and ethics at uni.
Mm-hmm.
Is it one of your favourite subjects? It was one of mine.
Really?
No.
No, fortunately not. Can I be honest?
Why?
It's actually the glue that binds what we do together.
It's interesting. It's very interesting. It's law is so broad. There's so many different acts.
Depending on each state.
Yes.
You've looked at Queensland.
Yep.
Yeah,
yes, and then ethics is a whole other conversation. So to me, I found it really hard to it's not that it's not tangible, but it's just not as straightforward as studying trauma or anatomy or physiology. It's very broad. It's lots of grey areas.
You know, years ago, and it wouldn't have been not long after you and I were working together because I had only just qualified, and I was presented with a case that put me way outside of the realms of anything you'd expect. And it was essentially a 3-year-old child choking in front of us. The child had been down for, I think our response time had been 8 minutes. How many choking kids have you been dispatched to?
A few.
Yeah. Lou, replacement, choking? No.
Zero.
Look, a lot of the choking kids you go to are actually just coughing and parents are a bit panicked. So I hadn't actually been doing a complete obstruction either. This 3-year-old was a complete obstruction. And you talk about imposter syndrome. Holy shit, I did not want to be there. But when we got inside, the child was lying on the floor and was clearly hypoxic, dilated pupils, had been down for 8 minutes, had allegedly been eating steak. It was 10 o'clock at night. What was a 3-year-old eating steak at 10 o'clock at night for? I have no idea.
Felt like steak.
But long story short, this was back when laryngoscopy was actually contraindicated for patients less than 8 years old. So I've got a legal scope of practice that says I can perform that skill, but only on children who are 8 years and above. Now, there are reasons for that, right? But I've got a 3-year-old in front of me who's not in arrest, who is 35, 40 minutes from the nearest regional hospital, who is going to die in the next 2 minutes. And so I made a very conscious decision that I knew I was about to go outside of my scope of practice, but I wasn't prepared to let a child die. I wanted to try. And I did ask the guy that was working with me to try and ring the medical director and at least have a conversation, but we couldn't. And so we'd made the decision to actually go in, and I promise you we did it badly. But we actually cleared the airway, and we managed to provide some oxygenation, and we actually ventilated this child to the point where they made a complete recovery within about an hour. The case presented itself as a legal and ethical dilemma because legally we actually couldn't intervene, whereas ethically I decided to.
Yeah.
Now, the outcomes of that put me in a really awkward spot where it was almost a show cause. Well, why should you work for our service anymore?
Really?
Wow.
Well, we've gone way outside our scope on a 3-year-old. And, it went through days and days of stress. And in the end, we basically got told that, look, you've gone way outside of your scope. Right? So you do need to be reprimanded for that. But because this case had a positive outcome, you won't be reprimanded today. There was a recommendation that you be commended, but because you've gone so far outside your scope, you will not be commended. You will not be reprimanded. Don't do it again.
What?
Look, that's beside the point. What I'm saying is when we're providing care, even in a remote context, it doesn't matter if you're in an ambulance service, there's so many remote instances where the alleged scope of practices that are delivered actually don't cover the remote practitioners.
So sometimes with remote expeditions, do you think because there's so many variables at play?
So many variables.
That there isn't like a guideline or a protocol or a set of framework you can necessarily apply across all different types.
There's no guidelines.
It's all a bit loose, really.
Mm. Look, the definition of loose sometimes is thrown around, and it's often thrown around in a negative light, and it's often thrown around quite critically by people who have either not had the courage to practice outside in this area or have not had the opportunity. It's better to criticize something that I haven't done or can't do than actually try and understand it.
So I guess the question is, how do we provide support in a remote setting on an expedition without frameworks?
So one of the tools that I use as soon as I get a job, so I mean this expedition you're referring to is in the middle of the Australian desert. It's in summertime, so we're looking at 40 plus degrees.
Beautiful.
We're working with elite athletes and elite motorsport, and it is high octane stuff, incredible speeds. We got vehicles in the air, we got vehicles on the ground, we got film crews everywhere. It was a crew of about 40. And I was tasked with basically keeping them safe. Now, I get to work with a safety supervisor, but they are looking at me like I am the medical SME. And so one of the tools that I've learned to use is a top three model. Have you heard of the top three model before,
Lou? I have not.
You can apply this to just about any situation to help you prepare, right? And it can be a top five model as well. I have used a top five model.
Or top six?
Yeah, or top 10. No, now we're getting too far, right?
Top 33.
I'm going to run with top three. Because that's what I've used a lot. What are the three most catastrophic things that I expect to happen, right? Or that could happen based on the geography, based on the location, based on the activity? What are the three most catastrophic things? Now, the top of the most catastrophic thing is going to be someone's heart stopping, right? Regardless, that's going to be the most catastrophic thing. And so we need to have elements of either being able to respond to that or prepare people for the eventuality that, hey, listen, if someone's heart stops and we are in this location, they're not going to survive. And that's the reality of working on these expeditions, is actually preparing everyone mentally for the fact that not everyone might come home. We are working in an uncontrolled environment. You can't put people in the Southern Ocean, 1,000 kilometers offshore, working in some of the most freezing oceans in the world with some of the largest great whites, and not accept that the risk, then not accept that the risk exists that people might die, but they're going to shoot some great TV. Right? Now, This is where it does become, a legal ethical dilemma, is where does our responsibilities stop? But the top three model enables us to at least create a strategy. These are the three most catastrophic things. And here are the three most likely things to occur repeatedly. Now, often they do not intersect, because the three most catastrophic things hopefully have been managed through multiple layers of risk assessments. But we still need to be prepared for the Swiss cheese model. The three most likely are all the other things. So if we are working on the Southern Ocean, well, people are probably going to be quite cold if they come out of the water. They haven't been bitten in half. So we've got to look at, cold injury, hypothermia, things like that, seasickness, exposure, homesickness. They're the three most likely. And so if we can reverse engineer those six things, three most catastrophic, three most likely, and create strategies to respond to them, everything else in the middle kind of works itself. Right, and that's how we build the kit, that's how we build the approach, that's how we build the response, and that's how we build essentially the ethical and legal framework to be able to provide care. And that's what then reduces that risk assessment from being red, hopefully down to orange, yellow, and sometimes green. Most of the time when we're operating on these expeditions, it is yellow and orange. There's a lot of red sometimes too.
Do you think that the challenge for paramedics is that we want to remove all risk, and sometimes we can't if we still want to meet the goals of the expedition?
Well, the irony is, Lou, you said before, what comes first in a primary survey?
Danger.
Danger straight off, but we can't always remove the danger. You're not going to crawl into a broken in half car at a power pole by removing all the danger. You've got to accept parts of that. Mm-hmm. But because paramedics have been brought up and trained in an area where they can then transport to help or bring help to them, it makes them incredibly uncomfortable to then try and manage risk in an area that we don't have help coming. Hmm. And that's a gap in how we're educating paramedics as well. And this is why if people do want to get out there and work, on an expedition, this is an area that you've actually got to develop yourself. And this is why things like the top three model are actually really useful tools. But we're never going to be able to mitigate all of the risk. We've got to go in there accepting some risk. And the worst thing that can happen is we're not going to bring everyone back. Now, if everyone on that team has accepted that, That's actually on the company that's providing the project project managers.
I was chatting to a mountain guide a few months ago. He was from the States, and we're talking about, you know, how litigious the US is. And I was like, well, do you worry about the fact that if someone falls on a mountain or gets injured on a mountain or gets killed on a mountain, that, you know, you're going to get sued, especially in the US where you get sued for far less. And he said in the States, it's very hard to successfully sue someone if they have an incident that occurs in a dangerous environment. So if someone decides they want to climb Mount Everest and they die.
That would be me.
Do you need to answer that? Ebony Griffith.
Oh, she's supposed to be on the film set tomorrow. Well, I'll ring her after the podcast.
What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. So if someone goes up Mount Everest, right?
Well, if someone even enters that environment.
In that environment, an altitude environment, and they die, well, then it's accepted that an altitude environment is a dangerous environment. And by entering, there's a risk that you can die. So unless you've done something that's considered unreasonable and not within what is expected or the standard that is expected by the industry or by the peers within that industry, then you really don't have much of a leg to stand on, right?
There are some things that we can do to make things safer, and that's by having qualified guides and things like that in the environment. I mean, if you even bring up Red Bull Road Trip recently, I mean, that's been released, I don't know, 8 months ago. That was a project I was a part of. It was an amazing project to be a part of because there was so much risk from so many different variables that it would almost keep you up at night wondering if we've managed to cover everything. And the irony is you can't cover everything. I got to work with some of the best in the industry, a lad called Jimmy Christensen, one of the best stunt coordinators, safety supervisor I've ever worked with. But essentially what they wanted to do was take a Formula One car.
Yep.
Off-road.
As you do.
Essentially for an 8-minute advert.
Uh-huh. Have you seen a F1 car off-road when you go forward driving, Lou?
I hadn't.
I don't think I can remember.
I hadn't. Now imagine how much money it costs to even get an F1 car out in the middle of the desert.
Mm. More than $100.
They are not cheap.
Well, it's not cheap. They've also got a pit crew, 10-person pit crew to keep it running.
What?
Yep. Those lads had to fly straight in from England. So they came from an English winter into our summer. So one of the things that I didn't include in the top three model was the lack of, acclimatisation of these English lads to our heat. I mean, they suffered through it, but I mean, they did well too. But the car couldn't go slower than 160 kilometres an hour; it would overheat.
How does that work?
Well, it's a very unique engine.
Is it like it needs the wind moving through it to cool
it's
it?
It's loud. But I mean, this the nature of this expedition was so different to most of the other things I've done in a natural environment, because this was taking something that clearly wasn't made for that environment out there. It's like the guys that carried a treadmill to the top of the highest mountain in Scotland. Like, you just, some of the stuff boggles your mind. But one of the questions that Jimmy asked was, what's the clearance on the car? And that was a really good question, because the clearance on the car was about less than an inch. And we both went walking the route later that day, and it was covered in pebbles. And so for the next 9.5 hours, the most clinical thing I could do, the most medical thing I could do, you know, 10 years of clinical study, was get a broom with Jimmy and sweep a dirt road for several kilometres to remove the pebbles from it that would then reduce the risk. So while everyone does accept the risk in these environments, I mean, the driver's never driven off-road before either, let alone the car that can't go slow on 160 kilometres an hour. But one of the things that we could do was something that would not be in a manual. It would not be communicated. I mean, I would struggle to believe that there's someone else out there that has swept over 5 kilometres of dirt road out in the outback. Especially as part of a clinical role. So whilst there is an acceptance of risk, we can still look at certain aspects of it to make it safer. And this is where, you know, if we're in a mountain, we're going to have crampons, we're going to have rope, and we're going to orientate everyone in how to use those safely to try and keep them safe. But there's also got to be an element of an acceptance that in an uncontrolled environment, not everything can be controlled. So the other aspect of Dakota's question then with the ethical dilemma is your clinical interventions. You can't carry everything with you if you are climbing the mountain. You can't climb everything with you if you're sailing in a 12-foot schooner across the Drake Passage. And so you've got to look very carefully at what you've got. And this is where, you know, things like the top three model are really useful, because then you can look at what you must take, what you can't be without, or what you can't improvise. And probably the biggest thing for me that I know that I can't improvise is drugs. You can improvise most other clinical interventions, but you can't improvise drugs. And so when we're using the top three model, it's looking at what are the pharmacological interventions you may need or may require on that expedition to actually look after people. The other aspect is actually pre-existing conditions. Now, if someone does have pre-existing conditions, they're going to have to seek special permission. And again, like you said, Nick, it comes down to their own responsibility. But I will always put any pre-existing conditions back on the person who's managing it. I'm not there to manage someone's diabetes. They live their life with that diabetes. I'm not there to manage someone's ACS. They are there to live with it. So they must carry their own medications. They must stick to their own schedule. But I will be aware of it in case there's a complication arise from it.
I was in a tea house in Nepal. And a lady came up to me and she goes, "Are you guys medical?" I was like, "Yeah, why?" She goes, "Can I ask a question?" I'm like, "Yeah, no worries." She's like, "I have diabetes and I don't feel well." And she gave me some more information. But what she wanted to know was our advice about whether she should continue to trek into the mountains away from healthcare. I was like, "Well, you know what? I can't really help you. And I shouldn't be helping you. And maybe you shouldn't be here."
So, I mean, it's even more complicated than that, isn't it? Because you're in Nepal, which has their own health ministry, which fails to recognize paramedics as a health profession. So you actually can't practice as a paramedic in Nepal.
No.
And again, this is where the preparation of a paramedic working on these expeditions comes into play, because both ethically and legally, you are not to practice in Nepal.
So this is, yeah, I was about to say ethically, you might have the skills and capabilities and you might have a client that wants you to practice at a certain level, but you have to balance that against what you're allowed to do where you're going. So, for example, I could go to Nepal and I could go and buy all the drugs that I carry in Australia and I could pack a kit and take it with me and provide the same level of care that I do here. But ethically, or legally, I'm not allowed to do that. Ethically, I might want to do it, and ethically, my client might want me to do it because of the risk associated with what they're doing in that country, but legally, I'm not allowed to do it.
And this is a collision of professional responsibility. I mean, look,
it's about having that conversation of, yes, I can do this, but it doesn't mean I can do it in the context of what you want to do or where you want to go.
This list could be quite large, but, I mean, there are four key key ethical considerations when we're delivering healthcare. Consent is one of them. We've got to have consent from the people before we can actually deliver care. The other is responsibility and responsiveness. So how responsive were we to what we saw based on our clinical training? Responsibility, what responsibility do we actually have to those people? So this woman in the mountains, you actually had none. But to the team that you're guiding it, depending on kind of contract you're under and what healthcare structure you're under. And then there's also competence. So what are you doing to maintain the validity of your qualification? How competent are you to be delivering these things? So the private sector is a largely unregulated space when people look at it from the historical structures of the way things have been. But what we've always got to come back to, especially for Australian paramedics delivering care ethically and responsibly, is your ARPA registration. It's not your certificate of practice with the ambulance. It's not your car. It's your ARPA registration. And that actually defines how you can deliver care. And if you actually unpack what that registration says in a lot of confusing paragraphs, it basically says you can deliver the care to the level you've been trained. But that is within the boundaries of the Australian borders. Outside of that, we actually have no jurisdictional authority. We actually have no legal responsibility. And so ethically, you need to be careful. We need to understand those healthcare systems. So I've been to the Himalayas probably a dozen times on different climbing trips over the last 20 years. And I have been there in both medical and non-medical roles. If I'm there in a medical role, I've made sure that language in the contract specifies I might be a paramedic, but I can't practice as a paramedic in that country. So although I've got skills and knowledge, I'm going to be missing certain interventions that may be needed.
So part of your role to provide support ethically in these remote expeditions is for your team to understand the limitations of what you can and can't do.
There's always going to be limitations. Now, the drugs is an interesting thing in somewhere like Nepal, because you can literally get everything over the counter.
You can get anything.
But that is for your own use. And so, you know, the team, if they want something, well, go get it for yourself. If you've got it and can't deliver it to, I'll give you a hand administering it, but I can't carry it and prescribe it.
And you can't carry it for everyone. If you've got 20 or 30 people, you're not going to carry, you know, enough loperamide in case the whole team gets gastro in your backpack. You're not going to carry Hydrolite for everyone. You're not going to carry a dose of broad-spectrum antibiotic for everyone. And, you know, that's part of your – well, part of the role of providing good remote medical support is being able to advise people before they leave for the trip of what they should be doing themselves, whether it's immunizations, whether it's getting certain things prescribed by their GP, whether it's getting some screening done based on the fact of where they're going and what kind of pre-existing conditions they have.
And what you're describing there comes back to those four principles of ethical care or delivering care ethically. You know, one of those is responsibility. So whose responsibility is it? Is it my responsibility to even advise you of your own responsibility? Without sounding stupid, sometimes that is part of our responsibility. I need you to understand where these boundaries sit, and this is a list of what your responsibilities are in relation to your health and safety. And it can be providing your own pharmacological interventions. I mean, look, to be honest, the less drugs I can carry on international expeditions, the easier my job is, because the amount of times I've been pulled up at border security and you've got to explain certain things, get half the things confiscated anyway, I can't count. But, it, you know, for me, it always comes back to, you know, consent. We've got to have consent from those people, responsibility. Where are those boundaries? We've got to set those in place. When we are actually involved, our responsiveness to certain parts of that and how competent we are. If we are guided by those, well, ethically, you're going to be okay in this role. But like I said, it is a largely unregulated space, and I hear a lot of inappropriate language used by paramedics who are starting to work in this space because they lack the understanding even of the lack of framework, you know. So I've heard people talk about you're guided by the scope of practice of the company you work for. That's not true, because the company might not have a medical division. You might be it. You're the only medically qualified person that company has employed. Have you got your own scope of practice? Of course you don't, but you've got national registration that stipulates what you can do, but that's within the boundaries of what you do or the boundaries of where you live. So it is a grey area, but it's one that you've got to have an intricate understanding of, because if you get caught practicing what is defined as medicine in another country, no one's going to be able to assist you. You're going to court. And so, you know, part of this entire role, or, you know, this development of this role, is just understanding those boundaries. It is our responsibility to understand when, where, and how we can practice. If you don't understand that, don't do it. Don't do it. Be guided by a scope of practice somewhere at home and just enjoy yourself.
So the second part of Dakota's question was about what mental health resources are available to you.
Look, it's...
And I would suggest that there aren't any.
Well, it's not that there aren't any. It's just there's plenty of resources out there. It's which one are you going to endorse and which one are you going to use? Lou, what do you use as a student? And I'm curious.
My partner.
Hold on. Hold on. Is the university sending you out to real-time placement?
And you're just ringing your partner every single time?
No, we have support.
I've had a bad case.
No, we have, like, I think, counsellors at the university that we can access.
You have us.
She said she thinks.
I think. I know. No, I'm pretty, yep. No, I'm confident.
Okay.
And then obviously where we have our placement, there is support that we have full access to as well. But yes, I also have my partner and you guys.
What support do you have available when you're in the middle of nowhere?
If I have no reception?
We won't.
Myself.
Not your best friend sometimes. Probably your most, it's your biggest critic.
So nothing.
Look, again, this comes down to that pre-planning stage for me. Like I said, they employ you as a paramedic to look after the team. And this job is as wide and as varied as you could never imagine, because you just haven't been through the necessary training. And that's okay. It's a fun place to learn. But they employ you to look after the team, and they do not give any consideration to, well, what happens if it's the paramedic we've employed who needs the help? And so you've got to actually implement your own strategies. Now, one of mine is, no matter what I do, and as soon as I meet a team, I'll make sure everyone knows where the medical kit is. I'll make sure I know exactly who the first aiders are. And I will also deputize two or three people who want to do more. And I'll actually give them a little bit more training before we go, which normally excites people. in certain interventions so that if it is me that needs help, they know where the stuff is and they're confident that they can do it. Or if I'm dealing with a reasonably serious incident, they can, for lack of a better phrase, scrub in and start assisting me. Yeah. So having those pre-planning strategy in place actually reduces some of my own anxiety and, well, I'm going in the middle of nowhere and I'm by myself, because now I'm not. Now I'm not by myself and I've actually shared some of that responsibility, you know, one of those four key ethical considerations, with other members of the team, and they've accepted it. The other one is, the question around this is also mental health. And this is where, you know, when I get tasked with a job, I want to understand the geographical challenges that are associated with that, because I've been scarred for the rest of my life from steaming hot jungles from my time in the army, right? So when I get a phone call about, hey, man, we've got this expedition, got a crew going through Borneo, I'm like, sick, I'll send someone.
Why don't you want to go to Borneo?
Nick.
I have the opportunity for you. It'll be great. Yeah.
Ticks, leeches, sweat, rain,
noise,
mud, right?
It doesn't. Monkeys.
Right? Now,
monkeys that steal your stuff.
There are things that sway that sometimes, you know, like, you know, it could be you're going to work with the orangutans in Borneo. Oh, wow. Mm. Damn. Mm. Can we bring them out of the jungle?
Do orangutans like mountains?
You're gonna guide a 4-person film crew through the Ugandan tropics to track the gorillas. You know? You said tropics. Shit. You said gorillas. Shit. You know? So I'm always conflicted by these things because mentally that's going to trigger me.
Mm.
I don't like sleeping in the mud anymore. High altitude, glaciers, ice, ocean. I love deserts. I don't know why I love deserts.
Why do you love deserts?
I don't know. There's just something very unforgiving about them. Things can't grow. Things can't survive. And yet you're out there and you find things that do. It's amazing. But I've got to.
Is that why you like altitude as well?
Maybe. Maybe. I do.
Or you just don't like the fact that you can't breathe?
You can.
Just everything's more effort.
You're just dying slowly.
She's slightly hypoxic.
These are all considerations to take into account to even assess my own mental capacity to deal with that. Mm. Ironically, I used to be able to go away for 4, 6, 8 weeks without fail. It was easy. Since I've had kids, when I go past 14 days, I'm done. I just want to get home. And so these are things that I've got to take into account to actually manage my own mental health. Now, the question around this was, what resources are out there? Well, there's none structured. There's none that say, if you're going on a desert expedition, we recommend these mental health resources. And so you've actually got to do your own education, have your own strategy in place to manage a team, and then consider how you're also going to use those to benefit yourself. Yeah. Now, someone said to me years ago that sleep is your superpower. And I think it's amazing advice, because without sleep, you actually can't do anything. And so making sure I'm hydrated, making sure I'm sleeping are two of the biggest things that I use out on expedition to make sure that I am functioning and that I can cope. But even those get impacted sometimes, and having strategy in place to even manage that. You know, like if there's been someone who's woken you up at 3 a.m, 4 nights in a row for the same goddamn mozzie bite, you're not allowed to stab them.
Okay.
You've got to learn to communicate with them, educate them.
Noted.
And try and reduce the impact it's having on you. But then it comes down to also conflict resolution, which is another, you said, you know, how much is mental health support? Another huge part of a paramedic's job on these types of trips is conflict resolution, which is often actually directly related to mental health. You and I might be best mates here, and we'll hate each other in 3 days if we were to live out of each other's pockets.
Mm.
All of those can still impact us as well, and there's no one who's going to consider that, so we have to. Finding resources to support what you're doing is going to be your responsibility. Find something that works, find something that works for you, and implement it, use it. If it doesn't, learn from it, grow. That's a difficult one. But there's nothing structured. And I don't think there can be anything structured because, I mean, you could go to the desert 49 times and none of them are going to be the same issues. Do go on.
Interesting.
Lou, you want to work in the middle of nowhere. What draws you there? What is it?
I love being out in nature and just less built up areas, less people, more animals. And I think a part of me, I'm interested in the lack of health resources out in these areas as well. So these people aren't, you know, they don't have access to specialists or to hospitals like we would here. So I think I find all that quite interesting.
Do you know there's an amazing learning opportunity in these areas too? When I was working in Fiji years ago doing an evacuation, there was a serious burn on an outer island that we'd flown to. And it floored me, but when we got there, the island nurse had wrapped the burns in banana leaves.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't mean just like you would, you know, just wrap. She had expertly wrapped these burns in banana leaves. Like,
did it work?
Better than I've seen people here with resources dress burns. Yes, it absolutely works. It actually allegedly can work better than some of the stuff that we have.
Wow.
Yeah, now I could have gone into that quite arrogantly, gone, rip that shit off. What are you putting leaves on? Let's put a bandage on. But it's an amazing opportunity to actually learn from this. What have you done here? Please explain. Like Nick said, be curious about it. And it's amazing what you can learn. You know, she'd almost woven a basket around his leg. It was amazing. Yeah, it was
phenomenal.
Phenomenal. So there's amazing opportunities to learn outside of these structures too. And I think that's where people also develop the creativity that has been missing.
That's great.
Did we answer Dakota's question?
I think so.
We went on a few tangents.
Maybe.
Dakota, if we didn't, please hit us with a message. If anyone else has any comments or feedback, we'd love to hear it. Lou, where can they find us?
We are on Facebook and Instagram, and we have an email. If you want to send us through an email about any podcast topics you want to talk about or
just anything really,
just want to slam us for how crap we are, we love that too.
Have you got some slam poetry?
Yeah, send it our way. I think the email is it hello@theshiftextension.org?
Yes.
But we are also on Patreon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a training day coming up in March.
January.
We're really bad at delivering the dates. Let's just say there's going to be.
We're on Patreon.
Biannual training days. And I mean, they're going to be an incredibly useful tool for people because it's a safe learning environment.
Yep.
But our goal is to run these every year and just create a safe place.
And symposiums.
Students and qualifiers to come. And our symposiums. We quite enjoy those. They're animated. They're different.
Engaging.
We are unapologetically delivering education differently, and that just stems from essentially our own boredom in how things were delivered for us. So, again, if you have feedback, we're receptive to it. If you like what we're doing, great. If you don't, that's fine. There's other avenues, but you know where to find us. Nick, that was fun.
That was great. Well, if you want to learn more, head over to our Patreon. You can become a member for the price of a cup of coffee a week.
Lou's got koala socks on.
I do. I love koalas.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.